Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Union City, Tennessee, and attended Miami-Dade Junior College and Furman University. In 1968, at age 19, he won the U.S. Amateur Golf Championship. And in 1981, he won the PGA Club Professional Championship. He also won 18 tournaments on the Senior PGA Tour, including the 2001 U.S. Senior Open Championship. Known as Mr. Nice Guy, his name, Bruce Fleischer. And we're honored to have him as our guest. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Bruce Fleischer, who in 1968, at age 19, won the U.S. Amateur Golf Championship. Bruce, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Well, Jack, it's an honor to be on your show.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad, please?
Well, where can we start? Let's see. Jack, obviously you had mentioned I was born in Tennessee. I don't remember it. I grew up in a place called Wilmington, North Carolina, where those were my younger years and tender years, and that's where I started this wonderful game of golf. We moved to a relatively brand new development that had a golf course. I was 7 years old at the time. Didn't know what the game was. I loved baseball, but I started out caddying with my two older brothers, and that's how we fell in love with the game. And when I was 12 years old, I happened to win the Donald Ross Invitational. I remember I shot 78. It was 1960 at Pinehurst, number five, I think it was at the time, or possibly number one. But anyway, I just liked that feeling. And I knew right then and there, growing up in Wilmington, where the Azalea Open was played every year, having to go over there and being able to watch these guys and the way they dressed and everything that was going on, all the commotion and all the excitement, I just fell in love with it. And, you know, I've been able to live my dream, and that's how it all started for me.
When you were seven, Bruce, and caddying, how much did you get for an average loop back then?
Well, I remember actually pulling a golf cart from my father, and I believe for nine holes it was 75 cents. I used to shag balls for a dollar an hour. Did everything we could. You know, at that time, my father came to us before we could join and said, "Boys, you work the summer, I'll match what you make, and we will join," not realizing. I don't think he had any idea we could do it, but between the three of us, we collectively earned $300. We gave it to him at the end of the summer, and he kind of looked surprised, you know, because this guy works 6 days a week, and he had to match it, and that's when it all started.
What's the biggest thing that caddying taught you, Bruce Fleischer?
Well, I think growing up in that environment, Jack, somehow I was very comfortable with older people. I was never comfortable with my peers. That's why I was a late starter. I think I remember my first date was in the eighth grade. It was at a private home, and I hid in the closet all night long. I didn't know how to dance. I was scared to death. And my date finally found me. She drags me out. She puts me on the dance floor, and then the party was over. And that's kind of what it is. I mean, you learn so much, whether it's respect, obviously a love for the game. But I think you grow up a little bit faster. You know, not so much, you know, again, with your peers, but you see a different, it's just a different mentality. It's hard to explain. But it's just a lot of love, a lot of caring, a lot of respect.
Speaking of a different mentality, golf has been said that it's the 4 inches between the top of your head, your two ears. That's the game. Talk about that mentality.
Well, listen, it comes to a point, especially today, where the competition is so fierce that you've got to mentally be tough. And, of course, you know, the one that comes to mind to me was Jack in his day. I mean, he was able to focus, and he was able to just look straight ahead and look right through you. And I'm sure at some time point in time that Tiger had that same mentality. The guys that can turn it on and off and be able to focus and really concentrate and get into that alpha state of mind, you know, very difficult to do. But, you know, it's almost like having blinders. That's why horses, you know, wear blinders to keep you looking forward and one step at a time. So it's a game. It is between the ears. Once you physically, you know, learn it and ingrain it and practice it, and it becomes mental, because I think the guys that seem to come out strong out of the box, they seem to excel and certainly succeed a lot faster than where my career. I was a Monday qualifier, and it was, you miss a cut, you got to jump in a car and drive 1,000 miles and try to tee it up again on Monday. So the guys that came out fast seem to get it a lot quicker.
Us duffers, Bruce, we play each hole forward. You pros play each hole backwards. Can you explain the difference, please?
Hey, listen. 80% of the scoring game is practiced 20% of the time. In other words, the scoring game, which is inside 100 yards the way I grew up, is where you really have to excel to be able to get that handicap lower. Okay? If you go to any golf club, it's kind of interesting. You look at the driving range, and you'll see 8 guys hitting drivers, and you look at the putting green, there may be 1 or 2 players. It should be just the opposite, because the real scoring tool is, if you broke down, and this is where sports psychologists come into play, Jack. If you broke down a round of golf, you only have 14 holes that you probably or could hit 14 drivers. You know, that leaves almost, 58 shots later. And almost half of those are putts. So if you start breaking down the game, you realize that most of your scoring is putting and chipping and your wedge. And it's an easy mathematical, easy to figure out. It's just boring to do. And, of course, when I was 49, that was one of my pet peeves. I was going to become the greatest wedge player, okay, because I knew if I could become a good wedge player, I was going to make a lot of money. And believe it or not, and if you want to throw statistics out there, I was 64th in driving distance out of 76 guys. I was number one in money, and I was number one that year in birdie conversions on par fives. And yet I was one of the shortest drivers because I was an excellent wedge player inside 100 yards.
Drive for show, putt for dough. We're talking to Bruce Fleischer. When we come back, we'll ask him about 1968. 19 years old and the U.S. amateur. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula. We're with Bruce Fleischer. Let's go back 1968, Bruce. You're 19 years old. You go to Scioto Country Club near Columbus, Ohio. What happened?
Hey, Jack, let's go back 48 years, because this year I happened to make a show at the 2016 U.S. Senior Open, and guess where it was played, where I won the amateur 48 years ago. And I know we're getting ahead of ourselves, okay? But I remember on a Monday I went out to the driving range. There's this huge picture of me, okay, behind the putting green, shaking the hand of a kid by the name of Bob Barbarossa. I was 19. I think Bob was 19 or 20. A guy comes up to me, taps me on the shoulder. I turn around. He says, "Bruce, do you know who I am?" And I looked at this guy, who incidentally was about a head taller. I said, "Geez, I'm sorry, sir, but I have no idea who you are." He says, "Turn around, Bruce." I turned around. He says, "You see that kid carrying that golf bag? That's me. I'm 17 years old." And, Jack, you can imagine the emotional roller coaster ride I had that week of going back emotionally, remembering certain things. But to go back 48 years, yes, I can remember certain parts of it. And I also can remember the last 3 holes where I was in this sort of alpha, where I was off the ground watching myself swing. I only had one other experience like that, and that came sometime later. But that's really about all I remember.
Arnold Palmer has said that the U.S. Amateur is the hardest golf tournament in the world to win. Explain to us the format and the reason why.
Well, I think any golf tournament is very difficult to win today, in today's world. The Amateur, you have got so much qualifying, so many sectional and regionals in order to even get there. And there must have been, 1,000 players that tried to qualify. And it's just a very difficult process. And, of course, there was a 5-year window when it was stroke play, okay? And I think today is match. But there was a time between, I believe, 1965 to 1970, it was medal. And I happened to be in that window. I'm not quite sure which was more difficult because, you know, on any given day, another player could beat you. But over 4 days of golf, you got to play very consistent to win.
How did you celebrate that Sunday night when you won?
I can assure you I was flying high. There was a guy by the name of Charlie DeLuca and Frank Purpich that flew up Sunday morning, unbeknownst to me. And they were waiting for me on the 18th green when I won. And if I remember correctly, it was a fun night. I didn't drink, so I didn't go that route. But I can assure you, I was flying high.
A month and a half ago at Oakland Hills, another 19-year-old, Curtis Luck from Australia, won the 2016 U.S. Amateur Championship. His dad was his caddy, carried the bag. What advice would you give to young Curtis Luck?
Well, you know, I think sometimes, listen, this worked in his favor, obviously. I've seen a lot of parents that, to me, get in the way. You know, you got to learn to walk before you can run. And sometimes parents are a little bit overpowering. And even though, you know, as a son, you certainly won't, you know, go against your father. But I think it's an unusual case. This kid obviously can play. I did happen to watch that match, the last 9 holes, and he's a wonderful player. And it's just, but you know what's interesting, Jack? You really don't know until you get out there because, you know, playing for trophies and medals is different than playing for money. Now, obviously, today these kids are younger, and their certainly experience a lot greater than when we were growing up because of the opportunity of what's available today in all formats of golf, you know, whether it's junior high and high school. And I mean, I got a 10-year-old on the golf team at the PGA down here in Palm Beach. And that's, you know, the opportunities are just insurmountable today, you know.
Who's the best golfer you ever saw?
I look at guys like Trevino, and you know, today to me, the game is more about sensationalism. It's just how far you can hit it. I don't think the rough is as bad today. I think it's you know, these guys are entertainers more so today. But a guy like Trevino, who obviously Jack Nicklaus controlled his ball, but Trevino seemed to me he understood it. He understood, you know, what he could or couldn't do, and he played within himself. And he would just go around a golf course. He could manage himself so beautifully. And when it called for a certain shot, he was able to pull it off. I'd have to go with Lee Trevino.
You have a special place in your heart for Jack Nicklaus and his wife, Barbara. Tell us about Jack Nicklaus and then why the special place in your heart for Barbara Nicklaus.
Well, you know, Jack, the greatest player that ever lived when it comes to, you know, holding records, and I think that's undisputed. You can talk about Tiger and his greatness, obviously, you know, his time at every level. But Jack, you know, Jack is hard to get close to. I don't think he ever allowed it. I think that was his way. That was his intimidation, you know. Barbara, on the other hand, is one of the most remarkable people that I've ever met. My wife got very sick in 1980. And Barbara would drive 2.5 hours twice a week to come down to take care of me and her and baby Jessica at the time. And she fed us. I mean, and this went on for weeks and weeks and weeks. And to this day, she hand delivers Jessica, who was 36 years old, a Christmas gift. Okay. hand delivers it herself with her busy schedule. I mean, this woman is relentless. She does it all. She's just very, very special, and Jack's very lucky to have her.
When you say Barbara came down to see Wendy and Jessica and you, it was a 2+ hour trip each way to come and see you every week. So
yeah, and I never asked for anything. I mean, just out of the goodness of our heart, and again, you know, we sat, we talked. I can't talk enough about this woman. I've never really quite met anybody like her.
The King, Arnold Palmer. How did you meet him?
Arnold Palmer. Well, my first time, obviously, was in 1969. It was at the Masters. And, you know, like I've said before, Jack, and I think I told you this story, and I'll share it with your audience, probably the greatest moment of my golfing life, because I've had so many ups and downs and so many emotions. And you know, I was always a journeyman. I was one of these guys that, you know, would knock on the door, and I made a lot of cuts, and I'm fully vested. But unfortunately, it takes guys like me to make up the bulk of the field to create an Arnold Palmer or a Jack Nicklaus. People don't understand. There's only can be a few greats, you know. We're all pretty good players, but only a few greats get to that pinnacle of this, you know, this wonderful golf game that we play. But it was 10 years ago, you know, in Detroit that Arnold was being honored. It was the 50th anniversary of the U.S. Amateur Championship that he had played in and won, and he was being honored, and the tournament director was trying to get all of the amateurs together, and make a long story short, there were three of us that got in at 4:30 in the morning. Two of the players decided to go to sleep. There was 7 o'clock breakfast, 10 o'clock pictures, 12 o'clock shotgun, and since I was already up, I decided, you know, I'm here for Arnold, and I walk in, there must have been 1,000 people eating breakfast, and that's when it kind of hit me. And we know Arnie is loved by all. I think they collected like $6 million that night for his foundation, which was pretty special. And not more than 2 minutes, I sit down and introduce myself to the round table I'm sitting at. Guy gets up and says, "Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sorry to announce that Bruce Fleischer and John Harris and Jay Siegel, you know, won't be joining us this morning." And I raised my hand. I wanted to be recognized. You know, I'm here. And which was not really a mistake, but it was a mistake at the time, because he waved me on up, and I go up, and he throws a microphone right in my face, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I'm shaking like a dog. And Arnie's in there about 20 feet in front of me, big old smile, sitting up, and something came over me. You know, I'm unprepared. I don't feel very good. I certainly don't look very good. But I look at Arnie, I say, "Arnie, I want to bring you back in time." And all of a sudden, he kind of sits up. I said, "I want to bring you back to 1969 at Augusta. And I want you to think about this 20-year-old Monday afternoon finding out at 8:22 Thursday morning he's teeing up with the King. And I want you to think about the sleepless Monday night. I want you to think about the sleepless Tuesday night. And you can only imagine what's going through this man's Wednesday night, knowing at 8:22 the next morning he's playing with Arnold Palmer." And I look at Arnie, and I start to shake. And I said, "Arnold, like I feel right now, I remember trying to tee the ball up, praying to God that I can get it off this ground, and I start crying." And Arnold Palmer starts crying, and the whole room starts crying. And finally, Nathaniel Crosby jumps up out of his seat, and he says, "Flash, you're killing us. Stop it." And I looked at Arnold, and it seemed like it took forever to get my emotions back, probably 30 seconds. And I said, "Arnold, I don't know if you really remember that day and time, but you shot 73, and I had 69, and the place went crazy, Jack. The place went crazy. And I have to tell you, it was probably the greatest moment of my golfing life, because I know for sure, as I've retired from this game 3 years ago, that Arnold Palmer sits in this comfortable chair at home, and he talks to his grandchildren, his great-grandchildren, whoever he's got around him, about the memories of his golfing career."
And that was the famous turning point event for Cornerstone Schools, the incomparable Clark Durant getting
right.
All of those amateurs together to come in honor. And, yes, we did raise $6
million. Yep.
We're talking to Bruce Fleischer. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Prisula. We're with Bruce Fleischer, whose nickname is Mr. Nice Guy. Bruce, let's jump up to 1999. You're old enough now for the senior tour. You have 7 victories, 7 runner-up finishes. You win $2.5 million that year after you were a 30-year overnight sensation. Talk about all of that years of working to get to that magical 1999.
You know what, Jack? When I was 42 years old, I was working at a place called Williams Island Country Club. I got off the tour in 83 for personal reasons. But there wasn't one day that went by that I didn't think about the tour. I didn't dream about the tour. But believe it or not, at 42, I picked up the paper one day, and this was what, early 90s? And I'm seeing guys like Butch Baird and DeWitt Weaver and Tom Shaw, who I grew up with and played against all those years, and always felt that I could play as well, if not better. And they were winning $400,000, $500,000, $600,000, and I'm thinking to myself, wow, you know, I'm down here busting it for my $35,000 a year, giving lessons, you know, running a golf program. And that's when I really started thinking of the senior tour, when I was 42 years old, believe it or not. And I decided I'm going back on tour. I was not happy at my job at the time. And I sat down with my wife. And believe it or not, in 1992, after 7 years of not playing competitive golf on the big stage, I got into the Bank of Boston and up at Pleasant Valley. And I beat Ian Baker Finch in a 7-hole playoff. And that $180,000 that I won that day was huge, because it gave me an unbelievable lift. It gave me a 2-year exemption for the tour. I didn't have to go through that qualifying school. And I was off and running. So if you want to talk about timing, because I am convinced, if you look back in history, the senior tour, and which it was called at the time, was made up of a bunch of guys retired in their 40s, because back then, 40 were too old to play. But the senior tour came along with a bunch of guys wanting to get together, have a reunion, and it just clicked. There were tremendous names and great competitors still at that time. But I knew if I could get through my 40s, when I hit 50, I was ready. And again, it's all about timing. And I am convinced that you couldn't write a script better than this one. Because when I hit 50, I had almost 5 years that I didn't have really anybody behind me that could compete and beat me. I'll give you an example. Curtis Strange, Lanny Watkins, Andy North, Ben Crenshaw, Fuzzy Zeller. Between the 5 of them, they won twice in all the years they tried to play out there. And I ended up winning 18 times simply because in my 40s, I competed on the big stage. These guys retired in their 40s. And when they hit 50, they thought they could come out, because they beat my brains out my whole career, you know, back in the 70s. But guess what? It didn't happen. And I'm convinced it's because they weren't competitive enough. And they weren't ready.
Bruce Fleischer, my hero as a kid was Ernie Banks, Mr. Cub. And this may be the year, after 108 years, by the way, that we win it all. But anyways, I was blessed to have him stay with me a few times, be around him a lot of times. And Ernie Banks, everybody he met, it was like you were the star and Ernie Banks was the nobody. He just had a way of making everybody feel great and special. And you, Flash, do the same thing. How do you do that, and why do you do that?
You know what, Jack? I am convinced that I try to treat people the way I like to be treated. And it's so much easier to be nice and to give. I love giving. It's my passion. I got involved with the first tee for the first time here in Palm Beach, and I just love seeing these kids. I love seeing them smile. This is one of the greatest games of them all. You can take it to your grave, and it's not that difficult to be nice. I don't understand sometimes some of these guys that walk around, and I don't get it, because this game can give so much, and it offers a lot. But when it's all said and done, Jack, honestly, and I'm not trying to be demeaning, it's all about, you know, what you feel inside. And it's just, not that it doesn't mean anything in reality, because you try to leave whatever you can leave, you know, to society. And but I didn't know Ernie. I've read about Ernie, and listen, I'm sure there's some wonderful athletes out there, but some get it and some don't. And the ones that don't, I think they miss out. I really do.
You say that you can take golf to your grave. My golf game takes me to the grave. Okay.
Well, come on down. We'll teach you, Jack. Okay. I got a guest house. I'd love to have you, babe.
You owe me that. Remember, you told me you're going to get me one of those magical swing trainers.
That's
remember?
Right. That's right. I owe you one.
Okay.
So, you know, I'm glad you're reminding me.
Okay. Gary Player. You know, we have the big three. Everybody knows about Palmer, Nicklaus, but Gary Player, unbelievable. Talk to us about Gary Player.
I think Gary Player, of all the guys that I've met, whether it's Sam Snead, I had a chance to sit down with Ben Hogan, I would say Gary Player, and I don't think I'm overreading this, is the greatest ambassador golf ever had. And he's elegant. He's an incredible speaker. Obviously, his record speaks for himself. But there's one guy I really like. I think he's caring. He can, if he doesn't know you, you feel like you know him in 5 minutes. He's that kind of personality. And you know, that's a trait that's very unique and very special. A few people have it. Most people don't. But he can make you feel so comfortable in such a short time, Jack. And I really always admired Gary Player.
We're talking to Blue Schweitzer, and I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Crisula. This is Anything Is Possible. We're talking to Bruce Fleischer, who won 18 tournaments on the senior PGA Tour, including the 2001 U.S. Senior Open Championship. I'm watching the Champions Tour a couple of weeks ago, and here's 67-year-old Tom Watson in the thick of it on Sunday. Tell us about Tom Watson.
Well, believe it or not, Tom Watson and myself go so far back, and it's amazing how the circle seems how to return. I'm living at a place called Ballin Isles, which was the original PGA. And believe it or not, this is where I played my sixth round of golf in the qualifying school in 1971 with Tom Watson. And I remember watching this kid that I always read about from Kansas City, this freckled face, redhead, who could hit it a mile. And, Jack, I also remember he never pulled out his driver. In the East Course, at PGA was a long golf course at that time. And, boy, could he hit a ball a mile. And, again, I think his record speaks for himself. He had an incredibly driving force, not only to work. His work ethics were superb, but his inept ability to be able to take it to that next level. And you know, again, it took him a while to really learn how to win. He probably lost, you know, 6-7 tournaments before he won. But once he learned to win, he was unbeatable, you know, back in the 80s, because he was one beautiful player. And you know, he's been able to withstand time. He still plays from time to time and still gets in the hunt. So, you know, he's proven. And obviously admired by a lot of people and respected.
Bernard Langer's 59 years old. He's in the hunt. He's in the lead every week. How?
You know what? Some guys, you know, Jack, not that I wasn't driven to be the best. I was never driven to be the best. I wanted to be comfortable. You know, I wanted to have my family comfortable. Some of these guys, like a Bernhard, who this is all he does, you know, from morning to night. It's all he eats it, he sleeps it, he drinks it. And he's proven that he's been able to do this very successfully. And he just wants it, and he loves it, and, you know, he goes after it. And I think there will come a time when he's going to look at it, and he says, you know, okay, enough's enough. I don't know when that's going to happen, but he sure is a great player. And you don't win the Masters twice and not be good. Trust me on that one. He's for real.
One of the great joys of my life was playing a round of golf in Tampa with Chi-Chi in a pro-am. Every human being should just walk for 4 hours on the golf course with Chi-Chi Rodriguez to hear his stories and to see how he interacts with kids, etc. Tell us about Chi-Chi Rodriguez.
Well, you know, Chi-Chi, again, here's a great entertainer who size, you know, you kind of figure, okay, here's a small guy. Who can talk it up and make a golf ball sing, and he did for a while. And you know, coming from Puerto Rico and with the accent, he just had a great way to entertain, to connect with not only, you know, adults but children, and he was great for the game at the time, you know. And you know, those guys are gone, unfortunately. The game's changed, and you don't see the smiles and the happiness out there anymore. You see the grinders, you know. And that's fine, you know, because the money has gotten so, so big now. And it's just a different stage. But Chi-Chi, you know, he was one of a kind. Him and Trevino, they were both. They could both just make you laugh and be entertained at the same time.
Chi-Chi made 38 holes-in-ones in his life. And three times, Bruce, he made two hole-in-ones in the same round. Unbelievable.
Well, he's played way too much golf. Way too much golf.
We watched the Olympics here a couple of months ago, and for the first time in 100-plus years, we saw golf. And a lot of these guys decided they didn't want to go. What were your thoughts as you watched golf in Rio at the Olympics?
Well, you know, you may not like my thought. I don't think golf belongs there. What bothers me, Jack, is that these guys are professionals. And, you know, the Olympics to me are amateurs. Now, I know that's changed because money, again, is a driving force. You know, basketball, you got professionals now, you know. I don't know if these runners are professionals. I'm not quite sure how you apply all that. But obviously, if they're going to have it in the Olympics, I think these guys missed out, whether it's Jordan Spieth, Jason Day. I think they missed out because it's always an honor, you know, representing your country. I remember the World Cup. I went to Melbourne, Australia in 68. I played on the Walker Cup. I mean, these are times that you can't take back, you know, and you lose. And bottom line is, you know, as much as they may say this and that, I think they missed out big time.
In a couple of weeks, we're going to have the Ryder Cup again. And it seems, you know, they say there's more pressure in these tournaments when you're representing your country. Why is that?
I think that's all, you know, built up through the media and the press. These guys don't feel more pressure. Sure, you're proud. But you know what? Honestly, you lose or you win. And the sun's going to come up tomorrow, and it just doesn't, Jack, it doesn't mean anything. It really, truly doesn't. It's a moneymaker for the PGA, and if you saw the bottom line, you probably wouldn't sleep at night, you know. So I'm hoping these guys get paid. I'm not quite sure if they do or don't anymore, but it's just, I think it's so overblown. You know, we play the rest of the world now, or of course we play Europe, and you know, it's no longer England or Great Britain. And these guys, you know, they say, what's wrong with America? Well, you know, the rest of the world's caught up with us, and we have to accept it. Very difficult.
A couple minutes ago, you said you're getting tired of watching Bernard Langer, you know, win at 59. Another person we've gotten tired of watching win is Michael Phelps these last four Olympics or so. What are your thoughts on Michael Phelps?
Well, listen, there's a great athlete, and you know, these guys, listen, I've never met him. You've got to admire what this guy's been able to do. And, at some point, and I think it's happened, you know, I think he's going to miss it. I think he's going to miss it big time. In fact, I was listening to someone who was retiring, and it's like, you know, watching Peyton Manning,
you know.
You don't think he's going to miss football, getting up there every Sunday and all that adulation and all that stuff going through your veins. These guys, you know, it's hard to let go. I understand. Listen, I let go 3 years ago, and I miss it. There wasn't a day that goes by that I don't miss it. But I don't miss certain parts of it, obviously. But these athletes that retire, it's like Federer. If you listen to him yesterday, I think he's got a knee problem, and he's sitting out this year. And you know what? Time is not on your side for an athlete, and it goes by very fast. So it's just. You got to find something to do. You just got to find something to do when it's all said and done, and that's not easy.
Speaking of being young, as we close tonight, what advice would you give our young listeners this evening?
I would say to the young listeners to listen, and it's the best way to learn. And I remember that the best thing that I ever was given was given from Ben Hogan. He says, Bruce, and I remember asking a question about the golf swing. He says, Bruce, do you own a shag bag? And I said, yes, sir. He says, do yourself a favor. For the next 2 weeks, 8 hours a day, go out there and beat those balls. Go out there, pick them up, beat them again, and I bet you don't have to answer me that question. In other words, you're your own master. You know thyself. Yeah, it's good to have someone watching you, but don't get so dependent. Don't get so dependent on one person. Be your own person. You're a lot better off, and understand yourself.
And Bruce Fleischer, you have been your own person, and it's not only the greatness that you've achieved, but more importantly, the manner in which you've done it. Keep up the great, great work.
Thanks, Jack. I appreciate it.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasulo. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohol.